So we've, in the monastery, we've been having our winter retreat. Started a week ago, and we've been engaging in practice with early in the morning till later in the evening, and also had talks each night, which has been very special. So our theme has been the Satipatthana, and this is we can call this the, sort of the frames of reference. This is around a sense of mindfulness, or the four foundations of mindfulness. And so there's been these themes spoken about this week that have all had to do with mindfulness. And I'm not sure about anyone else, but I kind of had it was a very uplifting week, and you know, a week of kind of feeling like, yeah, I'm happy I joined the right outfit here. So kind of a feeling of a lot of goodness arising, thinking about the Dhamma and a sense of how to employ the Dhamma, how to employ mindfulness, how to use what the Buddhist teachings are around our own recollection of Dhamma and our understanding so that we can penetrate deeply into what he's talking about. And so, yeah, this has been quite a rewarding experience. And just to kind of recap a little bit, Wampropasana was talking about one of the things he mentioned, which is very beautiful, that's been mentioned before in our Sangha, is that we can think about our practice as a holiday for the heart. So it's, we don't have to think about this as some sort of dour, overachieving, stressful practice that we're engaging in. We're actually uplifting ourselves, and we're bringing ourselves a lot of peace. And in particular, one of the senses of kind of when we're able to see clearly our own attachments, we might see that they're very difficult to let go of, our cravings and those things that we want to keep and we don't want to let go of, but we see that they're unskillful for us. But when we do let go, then there's actually a feeling of goodness, and that we've overcome some burden that we've been carrying. And if you think about somebody who's, for example, like who's an alcoholic or addicted to drugs, and they're able to sustain the ending of that addiction for a period of time, and then that time just keeps continuing, then eventually there can be seen that this sense of dukkha is released, this sense of suffering, and really the burden, the weight of carrying around this kind of attachment can be felt clearly. One is living in a way that is much cleaner and clear and not burdened through an addiction. And so one of the ways that Lumpur was employing talking about that was on this sense of what are really the aspects of the sort of second part of what mindfulness carries with it, and that's sampajanya, or clearly knowing. And that's been a kind of a theme for the last week, because a lot of times we're not clear with what we're doing. We're not really sure. Or another theme has been the sort of a sense of intellectualizing or trying to figure it out through thinking through it. And if we think about, you know, the aspects of what clearly knowing is, clearly understanding, have clear comprehension, it's really like knowing what our purpose is. So there's a list of actually four characteristics that are from the Visuddhimagga. And that's really important. You think about that. How often do you ask yourself that question? Why am I doing this? What's the purpose here? And that's an incredibly important question. It's something that sometimes people just don't think to ask themselves each time you sit down. Why am I doing this? What's the purpose here? What am I trying to accomplish or understand or learn? And if we don't know that, then that's okay. But we want to try to get ourselves interested in a sense of like figuring that out. Like, okay, I'm doing this for a reason. There must be some reason I'm doing this. And we can remember that, oh yeah, there's this sense we're all suffering. We can kind of really have a degree of sense. Oh yeah, this is about alleviating my own suffering and understanding how to do that. And so that's a very important question to just keep in mind. I think it's just a helpful thing to ask anytime that we're kind of engaging with our own practice and we have enough awareness and wakefulness to say, like, oh, why am I doing this? What's the purpose here? Because it's easy to just forget that and forget our purpose, and then we are losing that clear comprehension. We're losing mindfulness, and we find it difficult also to maintain awareness with that. And also, Lumpur brought up suitability. You know, what is appropriate? What do we see as being appropriate for us at that time? And again, if we're coming at it from intellectual knowledge, like, I have to figure this out, I don't know, maybe I should ask someone. And oftentimes it's just trial and error. You know, you have to figure out what is the right approach right now. You know, if you're engaging with something, let's say you might even be engaging with a meditation object and you're noticing that irritation is arising. So that might not be the right thing to be engaging with. You try something new, try something that's different. And so it's helpful to kind of think about what's suitable for me to be doing right now. And then you, again, it's not an intellectual approach. It's a sense of, like, what can I gain through my own wisdom? What have I understood? What's appropriate for me right now? You might be falling asleep in your meditation, so continuing to keep your eyes closed might not be appropriate. Or even something like breath meditation might not be working. So you want to try something different. So these are ways of kind of having a sense of clear knowledge and understanding of what you're doing, which really aids in that sense of having, carrying that awareness, carrying that sati in a sort of helpful, you know, helpful use of it. Because if you can't be clear, then the awareness is also going to be quite muddled. The sati will be muddled. And another thing was that I think was a translation. I was looking at the list. Is it's like amoha, I think. It's against a delusion. So it's having a sense of, like, what, if you think about it, like, let's say you're responding to something out of greed, and you just go for something, you take something more than maybe you don't share, and you take something more than others have. It's just not the greed that's being expressed. It's actually that's being covered over through delusion. You can't see that you're responding to it. I mean, sometimes we can see it and not have a sense of being able to be restrained around it, but sometimes we just can't really see what's going on. And we might express ourselves in ways that are very unskillful or unhelpful for us. And so really trying to make a sense of, you know, what's really happening here, what's going on, and having a clear sense of that delusion, clearing that delusion away. And one of the other, the fourth aspect that Lumpur was talking about is domain. And I found that that's such a useful concept with our own practice, like knowing my domain, right? What is the domain? If I clearly know what's appropriate here, what I'm doing, then I won't get into trouble. And so there's the metaphor of that the Buddha uses with a quail being caught by a hawk, and the quail's lamenting in the hawk's talons. Oh, if I had just been in my domain, I wouldn't have been caught by you. And the hawk says, "What are you talking about? I can get you wherever you are." And so I think it's quail says back to the hawk, No. If I was in my kind of area, like where there are, you know, where I'm used to, then you wouldn't be able to get me." And so the hawk says, "Okay, well, go back to where you want to go, and I'll get you again." And so the quail does, and the quail goes back, and he's kind of, I think what it was like. Around like fields and clods of earth and rocks. And so the quail says, "Okay, come and get me." And so the hawk, you know, says, "All right, here I come." And the quail is just watching, and the hawk's coming, and the hawk's coming, and the hawk's coming. And then right at the last second, it just moves slightly out of the way. As quails do, they can move very quickly. And the hawk misses the quail and shatters its breast, I believe, either on the earth or on a rock or something. And the quail knew its own domain, and the hawk wasn't aware and was actually out of its own domain. And so in that story, we see that the quail was right. When we know the domain that's correct for us, that's helpful for us, then we actually have a chance of preserving everything about the Dhamma if we keep that domain clear. So So what might this look like as a practice? Well, let's say you're kind of an external practice would be kind of just knowing where it's helpful for you to go. So if let's say you're kind of in some area around the monastery, and you just start gravitating towards a room, and but you're not aware, like, why are you doing that? And you go into this room, and then there's some other people in that room, and then there's maybe a sense of enjoyment, like, maybe I'll say something. And then blah, 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 blah. The whole conversation starts, and everybody's talking. But if you knew your domain around how to preserve your sati, how to preserve your mindfulness, you wouldn't have gone in there. You wouldn't have gone into that room. You would have stayed out. You said, no, this is very precious to me, keeping my sati central and my sati continuous and being more careful. I would have known that. That's the delusion that actually was occurring because you weren't paying attention. Like, what's actually appropriate to look at and say, like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go in there. That's not my domain. That's not going to help me. In other times, it could be something like knowing which meditation practice is helpful for you. You know, so you're knowing your domain in that way as well. So there's so many ways that we can think of that, knowing what the sort of the right sphere of the areas that we will be skillful in, and whether that's internally in our own minds or that's how to be externally in our world that we have to deal with all the time. So we're always learning a skillfulness in terms of how to think, how to talk, how to use our bodies, how to be in certain places or to be around certain people or to deal with our meditations when they're difficult. So just like that quail, we know, like, okay, maybe we've had a difficulty with a particular meditation object and we're not ready to go there yet. You know, we've found, oh, that one didn't help me that time, so I'm not going to use that this time. I need something that's going to be maybe more buoying or uplifting, like metta or something. So we're kind of reflecting on these things. And with mindfulness, it's important to have a sense that what we're really coming to understand is just knowing, a quality of knowing something. And that's not intellectual. That's not coming at it through thought or figuring out through thinking through it. It's just that aspect of actually being present with an experience and knowing that experience is happening. And so it's not that, as we've been talking about, it's not actually that complex. But that doesn't mean that as this week's gone by, you might say, well, it might not be complex, but it's damn near impossible. It's really hard, very difficult to do. And our minds are recalcitrant. Our minds do not obey. We might feel that we're not in control. And that's, in certain ways, we aren't exactly in control. We can always control it because sometimes the causes and conditions are overwhelming for us. And so we'll feel that sense of, like, I can't control my own mind. But we can express our own intentions. And that's what the Buddha said. He said that this is not his religion was not one against free will. It wasn't a determinist sense of experience, you know, that everything's already determined and it doesn't matter what we do. That would be what he called wrong view. So when we make the right intentions and we figure out what intentions are skillful for us, then we do have a direction that we can point ourselves in. But it's important not to engage in too much sort of badgering ourselves when there's difficulty in the mind, when we feel we don't have that control, even when we are making the right intentions. So as we're dealing with trying to be mindful, trying to know what our experience is, and finding just that knowing, that thing that seems so simple, so incredibly difficult at the same time, we don't need to tell ourselves how bad of meditators we are. So it's more important to just kind of take on a sense of, like, right, this is how it works. The Buddha said it's the most difficult thing to do. It's easier to be like a world ruler or world conqueror than it is to conquer one's own mind. So we know what we're up against. It's not an easy task. It's a very difficult task. And so I really appreciated what Ajahn Kantiko and Ajahn Guy and Ajahn Kurundamo were bringing up when they were just explaining the basics of what our practice is. You know, we're repeating over and over again. We're making good habits and trying to undermine our bad habits. And that takes a lot of time. That takes a lot of practice. But again, it's not through trying to maybe ask a question and say, well, just tell me what to do and I'll do it. It's more like, well, I will figure out through trial and error what is appropriate for me. That's what this practice is essentially about. And sometimes it can feel like you're just hitting your head against the wall, or you're in a room with no doors and there's no way out. But that's okay. That's just another experience. So we need to not be fooled by difficulty or by some of the problems we might have in our practice to think that, well, this is, you know, just the rest of my life. Or, you know, when you have a difficult emotion arise, you know, like some great sadness or something, it might last a long time. It could last days, weeks, months. But it's always impermanence that we're reminding ourselves of. We're reminding ourselves of anicca and the fact that things change. Even our perspective, even when certain emotions can stick around for a long time, we can actually change our own perceptions of what our experience is. So the experience of observing something like a difficult emotion can change. It can change, you know, how we are with just being able to endure it. So with the kind of reviewing of a lot of what we've gone over with mindfulness, one of the things I like with something Lumpur would say often to people when they would ask him questions. And these questions were often the same thing as just tell me how to figure this out, I'll do it. And Lumpur would often answer, just use your own wisdom. And he put it back on us. You know, we have a responsibility. And oftentimes we don't want to necessarily take that responsibility. We want to just put it on somebody else or have somebody else figure it out for us. But this path, it takes a lot of work. You know, it takes a lot of figuring things out for ourselves, and that's not easy. So I keep coming back to that, and it's okay. You know, that it has to, I think there has to be a sense of this isn't easy, but it's also okay. And not to get overwhelmed with how am I ever going to figure this all out? Because again, we get back into me and myself and my figuring it out and going at it through an intellectual experience rather than if I just trust my own capacity to learn, then I'll get there. You know, I'll just keep going with that intuition to trust, that sense of trusting myself, trusting that I can learn, and then making an effort in that very path. So it does take some interest on our part. We do have to have an interest in what we're doing. And we do have to kind of see it through some of our intentions towards ourselves and our promises towards ourselves. And I think one of the things that's hard to get to is to be able to think of what you're doing as something precious. It's really hard to actually think of your own practice as something you're holding up and you're holding very dear to yourself. So it might seem like that's natural or like, oh yeah, I'll just feel like this is just going to be really easy for me to know this because it's so important. The Dhamma is really important. Not suffering is really important. Being very clear, not deluded. But then we just kind of fall over again. And, you know, again, as Lumpur has said in the past, I really like, you just got to pick yourself up and dust yourself off and not make a big thing about it. And sometimes that happens just thousands of times a day, just kind of keep bringing the mind out of the muck. And again, it's, I think one of the hard things is just maintaining that intention and that purpose. So part of what we're trying to do is essentially motivate ourselves because that motivation isn't always going to be there. And if we're basing it on something like inspiration, because we can get really inspired sometimes, It's hard because that inspiration will dry up. And if we rely only on inspiration, then we'll give up and we'll find something else to do. So it's really up to us how much we are able to put forth an effort. But there as we've talked about a lot, there's really this emphasis on enjoying learning, you know, having a joy of a sense of seeing something and understanding it. And that doesn't come from somebody else telling you how to do it or from you trying to figure it out from like doubting, you know, what should I do? It comes from this kind of, long-term trial and error. I just had a couple of stories I remember that were from some of the Krubajans, one of them, Lumpur Pasno, and another one was a Thai monk, Thai senior monk, and he was asked one time about his practice. He was talking about how he practiced with food, and what he said was that he would walk through the line that we walk through, and you know, in his monastery, and as when he was a young monk, and he made the determination that if he lost mindfulness and turned towards desire, you know, sort of an unwholesome desire, got to get that, that's going to taste good, let me get that. And he noticed that in his mind, he would stop and he wouldn't eat. He would just take out of his bowl whatever he had and he wouldn't eat. And he said that was very difficult for him because he wanted to eat, you know. So if a day or two of this went by, he got hungrier and hungrier. So he had to be very mindful and very careful. And so I think another one of the monks asked him, well, how long did you do this for? And he said, oh, about 4 years. And, you know, that's a long time. And that's a pretty strong practice. It's a pretty, also, I would say, extreme practice. And it's not for everyone. It's definitely not for everyone. So it's important also to know our own domain for ourselves and know what we're capable of. So then a monk asked the next question, which you might want to know, what is the next question out of that? Why 4 years? Why did you stop? Any ideas of what he said? He said, because I had mindfulness intact. I didn't need to, it was continuous at that point, so I didn't need to have to practice this way anymore. So that was a incredibly inspiring story, you know, to hear and to know that a monk, as a young monk, he stuck to this for 4 years, and then he had continuous mindfulness after that point, so that he could give up his practice, right? So we think of this term, sila bhatta paramasa. This is sort of when we have an addiction or a following rites or rituals or something else. And a good example, he didn't need it anymore, so he dropped it. It served its purpose. It had no purpose anymore. And then another story that Lumpur Pasno, I remember hearing, and Ajahn Gai can correct me on any of this, or Lumpur. But I was sitting at Wat Nanachat, and Lumpur was doing a question and answer with the monks. And one of the, I think it was a visiting monk, it wasn't a monk who had actually trained at Nanachat, asked him, well, how do you practice when you're in the forest? You know, how do you practice when you're like in solitude in the forest? And I thought, oh, here we go. Lumpur's gonna say something here. And he said, how do I practice when I'm in the forest? I said, well, I practice the same as when I'm not in the forest. So, you know, it was a funny question. It was because I knew the answer that he was gonna give. But then Lumpur is very forgiving. So he said, well, I can tell you one thing that I would do though. And he said, when I was at Wat Nanachat, I took on a practice of just, I would kind of sit in the forest under a gloat, sometimes away from my kuti, and I would just do walking meditation till fairly late at night. And I just made the decision that when I would hear the 11:13 p.m. train go by, then I would say, okay, I'll take a rest now. And I think a lot of people in the room would, 11:13, oh my gosh. Because we all know the bell rings at 3. So, oh no. And of course, you know, there can be a feeling of that, like, wow, how can I give up sleep in that way? You know, how could I do that? And I think somebody else then was trying to figure it out, like, well, did you take naps? Oh yeah, I took a nap in the day, like a short nap or something. So there was a sense of like, oh, okay, 3.5 hours. I don't know if I can do 3.5 hours. But that kind of determination is very powerful. And when we decide to move into something like that to aid our practice, then we're seeing that purpose very clearly. Again, if it's aiding the practice, if one is doing that, but they're not seeing good results after maybe many months of practicing in that way, then it's important to see, like, well, what are the results? You know, is it just I'm just looking to not be sleepy, or is it more like other positive things are coming out of it, or whatever it is? But if, again, like, these are just practices to see rather than being attached to. So Lumpur found that was helpful for him. Another person might not. So it's not always the case. So we have to, again, use our own wisdom. We have to figure out what's appropriate for ourselves. What are we doing? One of the things that I just wanted to mention tonight is for some of the monks and also all of the monastics, really. But the bhikkhus start day after tomorrow, or we can say tomorrow night at 8 p.m., going on their solitary retreat. And again, being aware of, you know, clearly knowing what's really appropriate for that, what's helpful, you know, what is going to not get you into trouble. I remember one of the monks talking about if you don't kind of prepare yourself for your day and what's going to happen, you just kind of let it happen without any kind of sense of what's right for you to be doing, then that's just how your day will go. It's, you know, we have to really kind of engage ourselves in a skillful way, because we have these hindrances, we have these defilements, we have these things that are unwholesome and pull us down, you know? And like, I'm bored now, so I'm going to go do something that's going to be exciting, rather than, well, what's it like to watch boredom? It's not easy. It's very difficult, because it's easier to go pick up a book or do something, you know, like, you know, go outside and do something that's going to kind of absolve us of that boring feeling. But what's much harder and more fruitful is when we observe boredom, then we're not subject to it. And in fact, when we observe it very clearly, it goes away. But when we're watching it, then we learn about it. When we're engaging with something difficult. And so there are times on this retreat that we will be going through a fair amount of boredom. You know, I don't know, what should I do with my time? What's the best thing to do? So one thing is just to know, you know, maybe make a schedule for yourself, or know, you know, how often you want to sit at a certain time, or walk, or, you know, what's helpful. Or like Lumpur, you can take that in mind, you know. Is it helpful for me to stay up later in the evening, or to get up really early? And so each of us is different, actually, and biologically, some of us might find it easier to stay up quite late and get up a little later, and others vice versa, to go to sleep quite early. And so these are good experiments we can try with ourselves to see what's helpful for our practice. Essentially, we're developing structures that are going to help us in our practice. They're going to help us towards a release. They're going to help us towards skillful development. And so we want to use some of those structures. It could be something like, okay, I'm not going to puja anymore, so chanting is helpful. You know, chanting by ourselves might be helpful. Or learning some chants. Or, you know, there are times when the meditation, or whether it's sitting or walking or doing, it just might, the mind might need something else. You know, it might want to do something else that's beneficial or helpful for it. You know, it's helpful I haven't cleaned my kuti in a week. Should try to get to that, you know. Or whatever it might be, or we go and we sweep a path. So there is also wholesome acts that we're doing. It's not just distraction. There are things that we want to figure out. What is a distraction? What's not? What is something that's actually helping my mind? But there will be times that, again, we want to be careful. I'm bringing this up again, but gravitating towards just sitting around and talking to others about absolutely nothing, and that's not the domain of clear comprehension. That's not going to support that. So if you find yourself kind of hanging around a public place where there's others, if you're all kind of quiet and diligent with what you're doing, whatever it is that we're doing in the monastery, this is the same. You know, it's really, am I getting myself into trouble here? You know, am I wasting my time? So it's helpful to think about for the monastics that, again, we have this incredibly generous lay support crew that have come in, and they're sadhuing us, saying, go for it. But, you know, we have a responsibility for that. You know, we have a responsibility with our practice to honor that gift. And it's sometimes helpful to think about that. Am I honoring the gift that's been given to me right now? So this is a helpful reflection, not meant as a guilt trip, but something to reflect upon. And sometimes people can answer themselves without guilt, without kind of shame, just say, yeah, it'd be better for me to go, you know, just be on my own or do something else that is more skillful, whatever it is that we find ourselves doing. So over and over again, what I'm coming to is a sense of really watching over our own minds. And as we've been talking about the four foundations of mindfulness, we're having a sense of really like immersing ourselves in knowing, immersing ourselves in understanding, immersing ourselves in learning. And when we do that, then we have the potential to gain wisdom, to gain understanding. Because what we're able to do is, as we talked about, the rather than thinking about maybe the word concentration, which is a word that brings up sometimes a fair amount of tension, we can think of unification. We can think of bringing the mind together, collecting the mind. And once we've started to learn what is the best way to kind of collect the mind around wholesome aspects, you know, what are the ways to, you know, generate a feeling of generosity or a feeling of kindness towards others or that purpose that I'm talking about, that sense of really knowing like why I'm doing this, what is this for, you know, my own ending of my own suffering. What could be more important? What could be more important than really that when we have penetrated deeply that there is suffering? Seems so easy, seems such a like an easy statement, there is suffering, but over and over again, we're hiding from it. We're kind of trying to get away from it and essentially not acknowledge that. And so once we do acknowledge that, once we do understand that our minds are kind of engaged over and over again in wanting something to be other than what it is, and that's the way that I like to think about dukkha or suffering is just that inclination towards I don't like it. I don't want it to be the way it is. You know, because if it's something that I like, I don't like what it is I'm experiencing. I want something more. I want it to be different. And so we're kind of trying to work with that so we can uncover that and see, like, can we be content? Can we really let go of that suffering and see where we're causing it through our own desires, the unwholesome desires? So just as we go along this retreat, just want to encourage that recollection of a sense of clear knowing or clear understanding, and to try to let go of figuring it all out or getting the right answer, because there isn't really a getting that answer without just kind of going through a lot of suffering and going through a lot of trial and error and just doing it, just doing the practice. So as we continue on, I just want to encourage everyone. This is such a noble endeavor, and you know, for all of us, whether we're on the actual Bhayagiri retreat or we're on the retreat of life, to just keep going and try to keep that connection to what is important to us in what we're trying to do in our spiritual life.